I'm going to start off by asking you to have a look at this. If you could turn the lights off, please. Thank you very much. And just to introduce what I'm going to be talking this afternoon about, so that there's a kind of focus. First of all, what you're looking at is a Durga image from West Bengal. It's from Calcutta. It's very specifically belonging to a family in North Calcutta, an old traditional family, going back to Raja Navakrishna Deb. And Navakrishna Deb instituted Durga Puja in 1757, which I'm sure you'll know is a very important date in that area of India because of the Battle of Plassey. And he was in fact celebrating the victory of Clive of India at Plassey. And because he wanted to do this in style, he instituted this particular form of Durga Puja. So what you're looking at is potentially the same kind of image that Navakrishna Deb worshipped back in 1757. So, you know, 200 years worth of history in front of you. And it's important that you think about this because of the style of the image itself. And what I'm going to focus on is the Lion of Durga, who you can just about see down below. And I'll just take you through the image so you can understand what the image shows. So if I go from left to right, on the left you have Ganesh with the white head, white elephant head, red body and dhoti. Above him is Lakshmi. She's standing on a lotus. In the middle, of course, is Durga, ten-armed Durga. To her right is Saraswati. And then finally to the right is Kartik. Below them you have the lion of Durga. She's standing with her right foot on the back of the lion, and her left foot is on the shoulder of Mahisha, the demon in green on the right hand side. And this is a traditional Bengali image. If you go to families in North Calcutta, this is the kind of thing that you'll see. Above them is a semicircular frieze, which is actually very, very important. And this semicircular frieze is called a chalchitra, which means a painted sky, a painted roof. And it shows scenes, mythological scenes, which are usually the Dasa Avatara and also the Dasa Mahavidya. And in the centre, you'll have Shiva. These images are around about 15 feet high, 10 to 15 feet high. This one is probably about 10 feet. And it's placed within the household. There is a special place called a Takur Dalan, which is at the end of a courtyard, which is specifically made for Durga Puja celebrations each year. So this is a traditional Durga image. The style will not have changed a great deal. If you think about it, this is quite a wealthy family. If they wanted to, they could have changed that style quite easily. They could have made it more modern. But what they have done is they've maintained a traditional style, as I said, going back to 1757 and possibly beyond that, actually. In fact, definitely beyond that. So, I'm going to focus on the lion. Now, I'm calling it a lion, but if you look closely, and this is the trouble when you look at images like this, because this is towards the end of Durga Puja. It's probably around about the ninth day, let's say Navami or Dashami, and it's covered in flowers. It's got the chandmala, which are these circular decorations. Very, very difficult to see what's going on. The lion is in fact white, okay, and this links in with the myth of Durga. But it's a very unusual looking lion. I mean, if I said to you that was a lion, would you agree? Would you think it is?
It's like a zebra.
It looks like a zebra. It is most peculiar. And in fact, this talk should almost be when is a lion not a lion, because this isn't really what I call a lion at all. Now, Durga is one of the most famous images in India, and very easy to kind of define what is a Durga image. And let's have a look at this one. This is a Durga plaque from a temple in West Bengal. It shows the kind of Durga image. Now, Durga being the goddess who destroys the demon Mahisha while standing on her lion. She's shown here ten-armed, and she's sort of got a sword in one hand, a shield in another, and she's grabbed hold of Mahisha's hair. The lion is pouncing upon the demon, and below is the buffalo that he is coming out of as part of the Durga myth. So it's very easy to identify Durga images to a large extent. So who is Durga? Well, she has a lot of epithets, and the one I'm going to focus on is this one, Singhavahini, or I don't know how you'd like to pronounce it, Gavin, but of course I'm not a Sanskritist. I come from a background where I learnt Bengali, and in Bengali it'd be Singhavahini. She whose vahana is a lion. Okay, she's also Mahishasuramardhini, she who tramples upon the demon Mahisha. Now, Mahisha is a demon who appears in Puranic legend or Puranic myth. I think we need to focus on this word trampling because it's actually quite important. It is this Mardhini bit of the expression, if you like. Asura is the demon. Trampling with her feet indicates sort of power, it indicates putting Mahisha in his place, but also the foot of Durga is also quite significant in the sense that you worship at the feet of Durga and so on. She's also known as Durga Tinashini, she who removes obstacles. Durga Puja is celebrated in the autumn. It's a 9 night plus 10 dashami celebration, and very often throughout the time in Bengal, any kind of epidemics, wars and so on, Durga would be the kind of deity who would be bringing peace and freedom and joy, and removing obstacles covers a whole range of things. The word Durga, this sort of debate about where the word Durga comes from, there are various definitions, but a Durga is that which is inaccessible. She's like a fortress, she's associated with the mountains, the forests, places that are difficult to get to. So that sort of gives you an idea about sort of etymologically her background. Do you want to ask any questions about anything that's there at all?
Okay. Durga is difficult to go to.
Yes, that's right. Durga is difficult. So she is difficult in the sense that she is related to Himavat. She's the daughter of Himavat, the Himalayas, and so she is linked with the Himalaya mountains. But also this idea that in the past she would have been worshipped by warlike people, particularly Kshatriyas and so on, and therefore during the time of Durga Puja it wasn't uncommon for people to do little sort of sorties, even mock sorties at fortresses, and do sort of battle reenactments and this kind of thing. So there are all these kinds of ideas tied in with the notion of Durga. And what we're focusing on this afternoon is the lion, who is traditionally called the Vahana of Durga. So what does this mean? Now, Gavin, being a Sanskritist, will help me with this, but va, bearing, carrying, conveying, that's a sort of part of it. And usually Vahana is translated as a vehicle or a mount upon which a deity is shown riding or standing, or else it's shown beside the deity. I think the last two bits on this particular point, this PowerPoint, are probably the most important, and that is it allows the deity to be manifest. Now, I quite like this analogy that the Vahana of humans is the body. It allows us to manifest in the world. In that, it gives you a much wider understanding of what Vahana actually means than just vehicle or mount. So I think it's quite a narrow way of looking at it if you start saying the lion of Durga is simply the way she gets around. Okay, so the Vahana here is much more than just a vehicle. And you might ask yourself, well, why is it that deities have such and such a Vahana? Why does Ganesh have the rat as his Vahana? Or why does Shiva have Nand in the bull, and so on? So we have this kind of thinking as well to consider. So let's have a look at a typical image of Durga on her Vahana, the lion. This is a 13th century Durga icon of the Malas. Okay, the Malas are a very unusual dynasty in northeast India. Their dates are sort of varied, really. If you look in terms of Bengal, they were in southwest Bengal, and they were responsible for some of the terracotta temples in west Bengal, for which Bengal is famous. But they're also as far north as Nepal. And this one here is Durga Singhavahini. She's riding sort of, as you would a horse, and she's sitting astride her lion. Now, if you look at the lion closely, and I do want you to have a look at it closely, you will notice that it is heavily decorated. This is not a naturalistic representation of a lion at all. First of all, along the legs you have decorations, okay? You have banding going along the head. You have a mane that is very stylized. The nose itself is very hooked. The ears are very pointed. This is not a physical representation, a naturalistic representation of a lion. So what's going on here? I mean, this is 13th century.
Yep. Just in the previous one. Who are these?
This here. Now, these are just attendants, really. I mean, this is a typical style. If you look above the head of Durga, you have what's called the Kirtimukha, which is the ferocious face, which is typical on what's called a toranal, this arch. And most sculptures have that. They will also have attendants of some kind. These are sort of semi-important deities or attendants. They're not intended to be, like Ganesh or Kartik or anything like that. These are minor, lesser figures. She holds a sword in her hand. She has a mace. She has a shield. Interestingly, if you look at Buddhist art, there is an image of Manjushri, which is very, very similar to this in many respects. Manjushri holds a sword, sits on a lion. And I will come on to this about the links with Buddhist art. And I want you to think very carefully about how art is used in India. And this is an icon from a temple. Okay. The next picture I'm going to show you is definitely not an icon from a temple. In other words, this would have been used by the Mala dynasty for worship, for ceremonial worship, would have been installed in a temple with all that entails. This, however, is not in that ilk. This is the famous image of Durga from Mahabalipuram. It's from the Pallava dynasty in South India. And there are several things here which indicate that it is not intended for worship in many respects. First of all, it doesn't fulfill any of the iconographical rulings. Durga is much smaller, if you look at her, than Mahisha. That shouldn't be the case if you are wanting to show the prominence of a deity over a subordinate and so on. And the figures around, if you're interested, are the Ganas, the dwarfs. So if you know Ganapati is another name for Ganesh. These are dwarf figures. Durga is shown sitting astride the lion, rather like this one here, which I have just shown you, very similar in that style. She's riding upon a lion with a bow. Mahisha has got a sort of club. Interestingly, somebody's holding an umbrella over his head. Now, I don't know what you understand about asuras or demons, but they're not actually baddies. I don't know if you understand this, but they are probably better than human beings. I mean, they do penance. They are granted boons because they are, carrying out these immense penances and so forth. And of course, the gods foolishly give them these boons because they have to, because they've done all these things. So, Mahisha here has got a buffalo head. The umbrella indicates some sort of, he's obviously held in great esteem. The club, some may say, is a phallic emblem. And this is one of the rock carvings in South India, in this cave complex. It's about 13 feet long, I believe, and is a representation of Durga rather than something that is meant for worship. This would not have been used from work. Now, if you look at the lion here, and this is what we're focusing on, to me that looks very similar to the lion that we've just talked about. It's got a very thick kind of mane here. Okay. Any questions on this figure here at all? So she's smaller than Mahisha. One of the things that is common in the legend or myth of Durga and Mahisha is that there is a kind of love rivalry here. Mahisha wanted link up, if you like, with Durga. Durga rejects his advances, and of course this leads to some sort of tension between the two, ending in battle. And these figures here, this is the demon's army around her. And just in case you're wondering what he's on about, are there lions in India? Mm. This is the evidence. First of all, on the left we have the Asiatic lion, and on the right the African lion. Lions do exist in India. Mm. There are about 350 odd in the Gir National Park, just above Gujarat. There are only a few left, but they were common. They fought obviously against the for competition in terms of the tigers and the leopards of India. But the Asiatic lion went right the way across from Macedonia, right Persia, Afghanistan, right the way up to Bangladesh. And some say these were the lions, these ones on the left, were the lions used by the Romans in the Colosseum, for their entertainment and so on, rather than the African lion. The noticeable differences between the two are that the Asiatic lion has a much thicker mane, this black mane. If you look at the underbelly on the left-hand side, it's also got a very kind of distinct flap, if you like. The tail also, the end of the tail, it's much, much bushier. Now, whether that is what is being shown here, if you look, the mane is very thick. If that's the stylized version of what we're seeing here, that's fair enough. So the African lion on the right, very, very different in many respects. If you look at the top left of the Asiatic lion, very thick, very heavy mane. Okay, does that surprise you? Did you think there weren't any lions in India?
I thought there weren't any lions.
No, there aren't. Yeah. What is surprising is that China, which has quite a strong tradition of lion, is not indigenous to China. Mm. And just in case you're wondering whether in India there are sort of near naturalistic depictions of lion. This is the Ashokan pillar, as you know, and that's 3rd century BCE. So it's not as though people didn't know what lions look like. Mm. So if you're thinking, the white lion looks like a sort of zebra because they didn't know what lions look like, I think I will disavow you of that, because from very, very early on. And of course, this is on any rupee coin or whatever you find in India, you will find this Mauryan or Ashokan lion. This lion, incidentally, interestingly, down the bottom, you have a bull and a horse, and of course the chakra there as well. And Ashoka, being Buddhist, putting up these four-faced lions. There's another one at the back as well. And you can notice here, right the way down to the chest area, this very heavily maned lion with a very sort of flat face, okay? And I think really, if you look back at these here, they do look like the Ashokan lions to some respect. So if you look at that one, the Mahabalipuram one, and the Ashokan pillar, they are similar in some respects. Now, some people have looked at the lion of Durga and tried to say that there are early origins of the lion of Durga. And the figures that they quote are two. One is Ishtar, who's a Mesopotamian goddess. Now, if you've read the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I'm sure all of you have, because it's the oldest book in the world, and it's very, very interesting anyway, Ishtar tries to interest Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh isn't interested, and of course all hell breaks loose because of that. But Ishtar is the goddess of fertility and war, and she's seen standing here on the right on two lions, and on the left there's a seal with her standing with her right foot on a lion. So that's Ishtar, and she was a goddess from Mesopotamia. Well, I'm also interested in the Babylonian lion above, which this is a sort of drawing of something that's represented in the British Museum, but I'm particularly interested in a few things here. First of all, the wing, the very large wing, and also the sash around the waist. And I'll come on to that later, and you'll see what I mean later on. And if you look at the sort of ridging around the sort of body of it, you can see along the legs, strange sort of thing. Now, it's not uncommon to have theriomorphic or images where animals and humans are linked together. I mean, the Sphinx is a good example, and lions were used throughout history to indicate royalty and deity and this kind of thing. The other is one which I'm not so convinced by, which is Nanna, or Nanaya, who's the daughter of the moon god and sister of the sun god, and she's shown seated on a lion from Kushan period, this is the first, the third centuries, on their coins. Now the reason I'm not convinced by this is because the Kushans are a most unusual syncretistic group of people. They are Bactrian or Sogdian. Alexander the Great would have known who these people were because he was familiar with them. But if you look on the coin at the top, you can see this lion with the moon, and you can see the word Nanna or Nanaya written on the left-hand side. And below it, if you want to buy this, you can buy it on eBay. Actually, I got this image from eBay. Is supposedly Nanna. And some people say, well, originally these coins were minted with Durga, or Proto-Durga, showing sitting on a lion or standing on a lion. I suppose one could argue this because the lion has that distinctive curve to its neck, its sort of chest is bulbous and so on, the sort of look of it. But I'm not entirely convinced that Nanna is the Proto-Durga that some people claim. But just to say that, you know, some people say that there is this link between this goddess Nanna, or Ishtar, and Durga. So let's have a look at the timeline of northeast India to see what we're talking about here. Now, if you want to learn about Durga, anything at all, that is the text that you need to look at, and it's the Devi Mahatmya. Most of the Puranas, from what I gather, and I'm not a Puranic expert, were written between the 5th and the 10th centuries. 5th century was very, very important for a number of reasons in India. You had Samkhya philosophy, you had Bhakti, the Mahabharata was finished by the 5th century, from what I gather. And this Devi Mahatmya text is the most important text in relation to the current understanding of Durga. And this was written in the 5th and 6th centuries. So the Devi Mahatmya. Devi means goddess, Mahatmya means glorification. And it was written during the golden period of India, which some people say rivaled Rome, if not, you know, went beyond Rome, Roman Empire, the Guptas. And the Guptas were the golden age of India, some people say. A lot of Sanskrit texts were written then, important things were done, particularly in art and so on. And so you can see there the Mala period, 10th century, and the Pala period. Palas were Buddhists in the 12th century. And so that's sort of the classical period. Then you have a sort of medieval period, what I would call a medieval period in northeast India, Bengal particularly. You have a vernacular Ramayana, Bengali Ramayana, written in the 14th century. And between the 13th and 18th, most of northeast India is under Muslim rule, but lots of dynasties are around at the same time. Okay. So you have the Senas, who are Hindu, and the Muslims, obviously up to the 18th century, we've just been talking about. And in the 18th to 20th century, the British come along, and so you have British influence. Now, talking of British influence, you, just a complete aside, you might be interested to know that Queen Victoria had something to say about Durga Puja. In fact, she banned it. She banned the people from her own empire celebrating it in 1840. She was very concerned because people from British citizens were celebrating Durga Puja, and she didn't like the look of it. Now, the Markandeya Purana. This Purana was one of the Mahapuranas, 18 Mahapuranas, written around about the 4th, 5th century. And in the Markandeya Purana, the Devi Mahatmya is slotted into it. Now, Markandeya Purana is the most peculiar Purana in the sense that it is not sectarian. You know, you have Shiva Purana or Agni Purana or something like that. They're all dedicated to a particular god. But Markandeya Purana is not. It's non-sectarian. It's dialogue between the sages Jaimini and Markandeya. And 13 of these chapters in the Markandeya Purana are what we call Devi Mahatmya. And Devi Mahatmya has different names. It's Devi Mahatmya. It's also, how would you pronounce this, Gavin? Durga Saptashati, is that right?
Yeah.
Yep. 700 verses. Now, that should ring a bell with you, 700 verses. What's special about 700? Pardon?
Same as the Bhagavad Gita.
That's correct. In fact, the Durga Saptashati or Shatashati has less than 700 verses. So what they've done is they've used sort of individual words and extended it out so that it looks like 700 verses. So why do you think that is? Why do you think Durga, this Devi Mahatmya, is supposed to be like the Bhagavad Gita? What message is being given by that? That it is in fact bhakti towards Durga. It has the equivalent status, if you like. So that's another name for it. And this is the one that it is mostly known by. It's called Chandi. Chandi is, again, one of the epithets of Durga, particularly in Bengal. It can mean ferocious or cruel. Some people may say that is the meaning of it. So it's 13 chapters. These 13 chapters are divided into three episodes, or charitam. And these are the charitam, the pratama, madhyama, and uttama, which means first, middle, and last. Interestingly, the Durga Mahishasura Mardini myth is contained within the madhyama, the middle one. And from all accounts, it's the madhyama one that was written first, followed by the uttama, followed by the pratama, which sounds rather odd. Why is it? But that is actually how it was written. The pratama is only one chapter. Madhyama is chapters 2 to 4, and uttama is chapters 5 to 13. And they are linked with goddesses. Pratama is Mahakali, Madhyama is Mara Lakshmi, and Uttama is Mahasaraswati. The division of the Devi Mahatmya is very significant when it comes to Durga Puja itself. This is an autumnal festival which takes place over 9 nights, and then there's the 10th Dashami. And each of these, the divisions of 3 nights for Mahakali, 3 nights for Mahalakshmi, and 3 nights for Mahasaraswati, followed by the Vijaya Dashami, which celebrates the victorious 10th, echoes these. And of course, the number 3, or 9, I mean, in numerical terms, 10, was beyond sort of understanding at the time, I believe. So 10 was sort of infinite. You know, if you go beyond 9, you're going somewhere else. So this is how it's divided up. So the Mahakali incident concerns, the first part of the Devi Mahatmya concerns the myth of Madhu and Kaitaba. Madhu and Kaitaba are demons created disgustingly out of the dirt of Vishnu's ear. And while Vishnu is asleep, Devi is wakes him up, and he dispatches Madhu and Kaitaba. So that's the first part. Interestingly, the next bit, and this hadn't dawned on me until I looked into it in more detail, is that the Madhyama section, with Durga slaying the buffalo demon Mahisha, is really to do with Mahalakshmi. Okay, why is that interesting? Well, these three, Kali, Lakshmi, and Sarasvati, are linked in with the gunas that came up in Samkhya philosophy. So Kali is tamas, Madhyama is Mahalakshmi is rajas, and Mahasaraswati is sattva. This division into these three episodes, three deities, three gunas, is a way of looking at the Devi Mahatmya that is particular to those who say there is an esoteric significance behind it all. Are we all clear in the room about these three? Tamas is the lower energy, the sort of heavy, that's why it's Madhu and Kaitaba are the disgusting dirt from the ears of Vishnu as he's sleeping. Rajas is a much more royal, if you like, that's the way to look at it, a higher level. Sattva is higher still, this is the purest level. And in a sense, you're moving from one to the other. But it's the middle section, and it's always puzzled me, why is it that Durga Mahishasura Mardini, if the Devi Mahatmya contains all of that information, why is it that it's just that section that has the iconography? And the answer obviously is that that is the first to be written, that's the core. Hello, Richard. And that's the core that provides the basis of the myth of Durga. So what we're talking about here is the division of the Devi Mahatmya into three episodes, or Charitam. You have the Prathama Charitam, which is the first episode with Mahakali, the Madhyama Charitam, which is Mahalakshmi, and the Uttama, the final one, with Mahasarasvati. The Mahasarasvati one is quite long. It contains killing of variety of demons, Sumba and Nisumba, Chanda and Munda, from which you get Chamunda, the goddess Chamunda, and Raktabija. You probably know the myth of Raktabija, where, you know, if you cut off one head or his blood drops on the ground, lots of other Raktabijas appear. There's also Dumra Lochana, who's another demon in there as well. So there's lots of demon fighting going on in the final section of the Devi Mahatmya. Kalika Purana. Well, the Kalika Purana was written in Assam in the 10th century and linked with Karma Rupa, or one of the pithas or the pilgrimage sites for Devi. And what the Kalika Purana says is rather unusual, and it goes a bit further in asserting the prominence of Devi. So what does it say about this? Well, I showed you the image at the start of today, and if you're not sure what it looks like, I'm going to pass around for you a picture. This is from the Durga Puja at Bellamath in Calcutta. And there's another one here if you'd like to have a look as well. What the Kalika Purana says is this, and this is quite a sort of an additional bit, if you like. Now, it's an Upa Purana, it's not a Maha Purana, it's a Minor Purana. And it recounts the exploits of the goddess Kali as Kalika, daughter of Menaka, the wife of Himavat, lord of the Himalayas. It has a strong Vaishnava orientation and describes Vishnu as Purusha and Devi as Prakriti. This is linked in with the Samkhya thinking of Devi Mahatmya as well. It was written, according to R.C. Hazra, by Vaishnava Shaktas during the late 10th, early 11th century, and extols the cult of Kamakya Devi in Assam at a time when there may have been a transition from Shiva worship to the introduction of Vaishnavism via Shaktism and the encouragement of Devi worship by ruling dynasties at the time. It recounts the Mahishasura Mardini myth with a few variations. The demon Rumba is without a son and asks Shiva if he'll be his son in three successive births on the following conditions: that he'll be a son who cannot be killed by any living being, who'll be victorious in battle, who will live a long life and be famous and fortunate. Shiva, as you know, Shiva would, grants the boon and takes the form of a cow with whom Rumba mates. Mahisha is born and is cursed by the sage Katyayana with the words, "A woman will cause your ruin." Devi kills Mahisha in three successive births in three forms. First as the 18-armed Ugrachanda, then the 16-armed Bhadrakali, then the 10-armed Durga. In Kalika Purana 62.154 it states, "Therefore the goddess accepted the demon Mahisha, who is actually the great god himself. In three births the Lord Shiva was Ramba's son." So there you have Mahisha, who is actually Shiva, on the right-hand side. Now some people make a big deal out of the play between Mahesha, Shiva and Mahisha and so on, but that actually, Kalika Purana, is what it says. It continues to say that because of this, the demon now remains under the soles of the goddess's feet. So the reference to Mahisha or Shiva remaining under Devi's feet may be a subtle allusion to the subordination of the male deities to the supremacy of the Devi. In fact, the Kalika Purana states that Vishnu and Shiva are nothing more than Devi's mounts, Vahana, or that they form parts of her seat, Asana. In the Kalika Purana, Vishnu is identified with the lion, Hari. So if you know anything about Harihara, which is an icon which has both half Vishnu and half Shiva, that's Harihara. And Shiva is identified with Mahisha, the buffalo demon. So in Mahisha Suramardini images, both are placed directly below Durga, who is shown standing with her right foot on the lion, left foot on the demon, communicating visually the supremacy of Devi over the male deities. So in a, this is a much more sort of overtly Shakta thing here. Now I'm not gonna say that that is actually what you know, in a Bengali, traditional Bengali image, is what is being communicated. But this is the Kalika Purana. This is Assam, which is regarded as a little bit beyond the pale, almost, even within the Hindu community. Now let's go back to the start, when I was talking to you and showing you the image that I did, and some of you just had a look at, which is this lion, this curious figure. And when I first came across it, and I first saw an image of Durga when I was 7 years old, and I've seen many, many Durga images, I've seen them being made, and it did strike me that this particular lion is most peculiar. And having talked to people at the Victoria and Albert Museum and various other places, I think I'm closer to understanding something about Durga's lion, and it's this. There is a mythical creature called a Vyali or Yali. It's a mythical lion which is more powerful than a lion. Sometimes this is called the Shardula, which is a horse lion. In Gupta period, it symbolized the victory of knowledge over ignorance. Now, I think the key thing here is that it's more powerful than a lion. In other words, Durga's lion is a lion, but it's actually in the shape of a Yali or Vyali because it is more powerful than a lion. Now, if you look at this is actually, if you can imagine a sort of a door jamb, this is actually something that would have been placed sort of along the side of it to hold it up. It's held up vertically there, but it would have been. And if you look at it, you can see the rather pointed nose here, which is unusual. It's definitely not female, just in case you've missed that. This is not a female, it's not a lioness by any stretch of the imagination. And this is the kind of image that, in a sense, appears also in the Durga images of Bengal. If you look in temple sculptures, you'll see lots of these on the outsides of temples. They're sometimes referred to as a leogriff, or a sort of lion-like figure. And this middle one is a Gupta leogriff from the 5th century. But on the left-hand side, you can see something called the Gaja Shardula motif. There's the lion standing on top of an elephant underneath with a rider. Okay, and you can see a series of these on the outside of temples. So the question is, why is it that this figure, which seems to be a sort of protector, guardian figure on the outside of temples, how does it make its way to become the lion of Durga? What is it that makes that transition? How does it appear suddenly? You can see the swirling figures along the thigh of the animal. You can see the sash across its waist. You can see the pointed noses. You can see the very pointed ears, the curious bulbous eyes. It is an unusual animal. It is not what I would call a lion. It's almost like it's got horse-like features, almost like the image we've got in front of us. We don't have the naturalistic lion of the Ashokan pillars by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, when people look at this, they just blithely say, "Lion of Durga. This is the lion." Now, this also appears on temples in Bengal. This is from the outside of a temple, and this is very similar. You can see the sort of pointed nose, the curious looking arched neck of the figure. These are lion-like figures or leogriffs from the outside of a temple in Bengal. Where is the lion here? This is a Saina sculpture from the 13th century, a Hindu sculpture showing Durga Mahishasura Mardini killing Mahisha. Her trident is piercing his chest, and on the left-hand side is a lion who looks curiously like a sort of Tibetan or Buddhist lion, which I'm going to refer to in just a moment. Okay. Now I just want to take a slight detour here and show you a coin which has a very peculiar story associated with it, which might give you a hint at the syncretistic nature behind any kind of iconography in India. This sultan's, Jalal ul-Din Muhammad, was from a Hindu dynasty. His father was a Hindu. He converted to Islam, and in order to get the sultanate. in order to appease those people within his kingdom who were Hindu, he minted this coin. This is the largest coin ever minted in India. It's absolutely massive. And it was allegedly part of a series of coins donated to the Ming Dynasty, the emperor. Now, I don't know if you know what you know about China and the Forbidden City of China. Richard, do you know about this?
No.
No, okay. Right, the Forbidden City apparently was opened officially in 1420. And along the roofs of the Forbidden City, you will find figures of lions looking remarkably similar to this. So this lion symbol is associated with Prachanishtha Durga as the vehicle of the goddess Chandi. So what the Sultan was saying in minting this coin to his Hindu subjects is, it's okay, although I've converted to Islam, I still think that you need to understand that I'm sympathetic to you. And the easiest way he could do this was by minting this coin with the lion of Durga, the lion of Chandi, on it. So he was telling them without actually saying, it's okay. Now if you look at this lion, you can see all the characteristics that I've been looking at with you this afternoon. You can see the stylized lion, the leogriff, if you like, the very pointed nose, almost dragon-like features, the kind of mane, the markings on the legs, and the sort of the thighs and so on. This is a curious lion. And if you look at figures from Indonesia, for example, or, as I said, Chinese lions, this, I would argue, is the basis of many of those kinds of things. So if you look in Far Eastern art, you will see this more or less everywhere. So this is the Lion of Chandi. Some may say that this is the origin of the lion dance and so on from China. Now this is, again, a rather curious image which seems to have very strong Buddhist links, and I'm very pleased that Richard is here because he might well throw some light on this. This is a detail from a Durga image from Kathmandu, Darbar Square, wooden Mandu temple, Darbar Square, from the Mala dynasty. So what do you notice about it? This is the Lion of Durga. There's the trident of Durga piercing Mahisha's chest. There's the buffalo head severed below. What does it look like? First of all, is it a female? Is it a lioness? I don't think so. You can tell straight away it's not a lioness. It has wings. It has a curious crest. It has large, flappy ears. It looks like a pug dog of some kind. This is not what I would call a lion by any stretch of the imagination. It has a kind of breastplate of some sort. Now, the only way I can really rationalise this is make some link perhaps with elephants in India. If you decorate elephants, you're kind of taming them, you're making them sort of part of human culture and so on. Is this what's going on here? Is the lion being tamed in that respect? Well, Durga's foot is on the back of the lion, as you can see. So what kind of lion are we talking about? So I looked into this and I thought, well, does it have Buddhist links? Now, Nepal is the only... was the only Hindu country in the world. Here we have, very close to the Buddhist north, some images. And the nearest I could come up with is the image on the right. This is one of the conjoined animals, one of the symbols of Buddhism, or two of the symbols of Buddhism, conjoined. So what are they? Here they are. First of all, you have this figure here, which is the snow lion. And the snow lion represents, apparently, unconditional cheerfulness, a mind free of doubt, clear and precise. The association's main quality is fearlessness, dominance over mountains and the earth element. Below you have the Garuda, which symbolizes freedom from hopes and fears, the vast mind without reference point. The association's main quality is wisdom, dominance over the sky, and the fire element. So you have the lion, earth, Garuda, sky. But if you bring the two together, you have a snow lion with a lion's body and Garuda's head and wings. And this symbolizes victory or harmony over disharmony and disagreement. Now, normally these two are mortal enemies, but if you bring them together, it creates what's called a conjoined animal. So if you look at the wings there and you look at the sort of legs of this conjoined animal and you go back to this, I think that you could probably argue that there is a strong connection between the two. So is it, is one representation of Durga's lion, in fact, this, the snow lion? Now, just in case you're wondering, there are no lions, no albino lions in the Himalayan mountains roaming around. There are snow leopards, but as far as I'm aware, there are no snow lions. These are mythical creatures, mythical figures. And the Dalai Lama took the snow lion, two of them, in 1912 or whenever it was he started, to be the symbol of the his flag. On his flag, you will see these snow lions. The Buddha also has lions below him in representations of the Buddha. As I said, Manjushri is sitting on a lion with a sword. There are links between Buddhist symbolism and Hindu symbolism. So what I'm trying to explain here is that when one tries too hard to say this is Hindu, this is Buddhist, it doesn't always work. In fact, there is a mixture and a commingling of ideas very often. What about these conjoined animals? Are there equivalents elsewhere? Well, I came up with this one, which is Burak, which is the mythical creature that Muhammad went on to in his night journey, or Miraj. Lailatul Miraj is the festival that celebrates this, on the mythical animal Burak, which he travels to heaven to receive the teachings from Allah. Female head, winged horse. So there are these mythical beings which are in the past conveyors of some spiritual experience, and of course within Islam this spiritual experience here is regarded more as feminine. In the iconography that I've been showing you, the lion is masculine, not feminine. Now, the lion of Durga has not always been there, in fact. There are images of Durga without lion. The Chola dynasty in the south does show this. But let me just show you some ideas of what I'm talking about here. Edward Moore, who published his Hindu pantheon in 1810, he was a very interesting character. He's donated a lot of objects, over 60 objects, to the British Museum. Did a series of very, very detailed line drawings of brass figures. This one shows Durga, and this is what he actually puts: Durga, Devi or Parvati, personifying active virtue, slaying an impersonation of vice, generally named Mahishasura. And I've given you there a brass Durga from the 18th century to compare it with. These would have been assembled. This Durga on the right hand side comes apart. There are about five different parts. The background is one part, Durga herself is another. The two Ganeshas were added later, around about the 19th, 20th century. But if you look closely, you'll see the lion there on the right-hand side is that kind of heraldic leogriff type. And on the left-hand side, this man, Edward Moore, has tried to show something like it. But a very small lion, rather sort of discreet to the side. Even more discreet to the side is another one which he shows. Again, a brass Durga, very similar. But this time, Durga's lion looks more like a little pug dog grabbing the back of the buffalo. How about this one? This is a Durga sitting astride an almost sort of dragon-like lion, Devi under various forms. Now, this is a figure which I would recognize in Bengal, which is a figure which I know as Jagadhatri, which is another form of Durga. And she's sitting astride the lion here. Again, if I said to you lion, would you agree that that's a lion? Would you think that's a lion? With horns and things like that? No. You'd perhaps be excused for looking at it from this point of view. And that is Durga from a painting, which shows her sitting on not a lion, but a tiger. And there is some a theory that prior to Durga receiving the lion as the gift from on which she rode, that she was shown or used, images were used, showing her on a tiger. But in iconography, Singha or Simha refers to both lion and tiger. They can be used; the word can be used for both. And this is a painting showing Durga on a tiger rather than a lion. And similarly, this one, which is rather a nice one from the Gula school from North India, 18th century. Again, she's on a tiger, not a lion. makes more sense. Tigers are more prevalent in India than lions. And again, a contemporary drawing of Uma. This is the kind of thing you'll find in a lot of poster art in India. If you buy a poster of Durga, this is more likely to be the kind of Durga you're going to get. So let's go back to the start again, and let's try and trace it. I showed you an image of Durga, which perhaps is 1757. How about this? Solvins, or Balthasar Solvins, was an artist who worked for the British East India Company, and he produced a series of aquatints. This is a new kind of style of etching, in 1799. And this is an image of Durga Puja. So what's going on? Can you identify it? Does it make any sense? Well, you've got the traditional Durga image. You've got Ganesh on the left behind the priests, or in front of the priests. You've got Lakshmi above. You've got Durga with her 10 arms. You've got Sarasvati on the right, below Kartik. You have the demon with his arm with a huge sword. You have a snake dangling down from Durga's arm. And you have the white lion, and look, there is a sash there. Curious kind of arched neck. Now, if you go to Bengal and you go to the artists who actually create these, who are the Kumars, or the potters, in Kumartuli and so on, they will refer to this as a horse lion, a Gorashingo, because it does. It looks like a horse combined with a lion. And what is the priest doing? What is the priest in the foreground doing? Any ideas? What do you think they're doing? Any idea?
Puja.
This is Durga Puja, and it's part of Durga Puja called Sandhi Puja, which is the conjunction of Ashtami and Navami in the early hours of the two. And it is the sacrifice of a goat, which the priest has got on the right hand side. The goat's head is being offered on a plate. And Balidan, animal sacrifice, is still performed. I saw it myself in Calcutta during Durga Puja. So goat is sacrificed in some families, not to Vaishnava families, I would hasten to add, but in some Shakta families they will offer Balidan or goat sacrifice, more than one sometimes. The priest in front of Durga is putting sindur, or red paste, on the foot of Durga. This is towards the end of Durga Puja. So he's not offering worship to the lion. However, that doesn't mean to say that the lion isn't worshipped. How do I know this? Well, the Devi Mahatmya has appendices called Angas and Rahasyas. And one of the Rahasyas says that when you worship Durga, you should worship Durga first, then the demon, and then the lion, in that order. Okay, so the lion is an integral part of Durga Puja. It's not an appendage, it's not just a mount, it's not just a sort of afterthought, it is an integral part of Durga Puja. Solvins married a very wealthy widow when he returned from India, which allowed him to publish an even more impressive book called Les Hindus, volume 2, and this is a sort of a nicer version of it, and you can see in colour what Durga, he imagines Durga looked like in this traditional Bengali house. And there is the priest putting his hand on with the sindur on the foot of Durga towards the end of Durga Puja. And then you have on the right hand side people coming to offer puja and so on. The Brahmin priest on the left are the officiating priests, and again the man on the right has the head of a goat, which is made an offering.
I'm sorry, I just can't read the picture in the sense of between the man who's coming with the head of the goat and
yes.
the next priest in the centre,
yes.
there there's sort of horizontal thing, which is dark green with white spots, and another thing sort of going
are we talking,
down.
Are we talking about behind, the below Durga herself, you mean?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Her right as we look at
yes,
her.
Below Durga, she's got her right foot on the white lion, her right foot,
her
left foot is on the demon Mahisha, who is very awkwardly leaning forward. You can see his arm there and a leg leading out.
Oh, that's a
and
leg
that's
of a
leg.
Demon.
That's a leg of a demon. And there's the sword. There's a large sword in his left hand. Okay, and there's a snake twirling down. You can just see the top of the snake above the trident there. Okay? So, trapped. The demon is trapped by both Durga and the lion. The important thing here is that the lion is very much part of Durga Puja. It's not a condition. Sometimes it's very difficult to see an image. This is a small brass image which had been used in a family shrine, which shows a very heavily stylized lion. I don't know what you make of this, but the lion seems to have a crown of some kind. It is more like a dragon. It has this pointed nose, very pointed ears. It is very much this sort of stylized lion I've been talking to you about. Some people from Bengal refer to it as the Arisan lion, and that struck my curiosity a little bit. So I've given you here a picture, which is a contemporary picture from Orissa. It's a cloth painting showing this lion. And this lion has a crown, but also a moustache. Okay? So a lion with a moustache. This is a new departure here. We have a lion with a moustache. And on the right-hand side, this is a lion, in inverted commas, from a traditional Durga image, also with a moustache. Any ideas why what a moustache would say to you? Putting a moustache on something. Yeah. It's male, first of all, yes? Anything else?
Warrior.
Okay, warrior. Very, very ornate moustache. And, you know, it's adding a sort of human dimension to it, almost. But if you look at the nose, this nose is very pointed and very hooked. And one can understand why there might be a connection made with perhaps Kalki, the final incarnation of Vishnu, you know, the Kalki, the horse that he rides upon. You could have perhaps an idea that actually this is semi-human, not just an animal of some kind. In the V&A, there is an ivory Durga, which was from the Great Exhibition of 1851. This is a very curious image. It's an Anglo-Indian ivory, and I was very lucky recently to be able to photograph it close up. And this was made by a group of ivory carvers in Murshidabad in Birbhum district, or Birbhum itself. And if you look at the right-hand side, there is the lion again that I'm referring to, this leogriff thing with this arched neck, very, very pointed nose, sharp teeth, bulbous eyes. There is none of the decoration, but it may well have been that this decoration was removed by overzealous polishing. This figure has actually suffered a bit from polishing by somebody or other. But if you look above, this Chali is supposed to look like a traditional image. The Chali on the right-hand side above looks like that heraldic lion that I'm referring to here. So this is 1851. In Kalighat, not a heraldic lion, more like a cat, to be honest. This is a picture of Durga from Kalighat in 1860. However, what do you make of this? This is Narasingha, the incarnation of Vishnu, in which he is shown remarkably similar to the lion of Durga. You have the moustache, you have the curious mane that you saw at the start, which looked like, what do you call it, a zebra, with the pointed ears. The Kalighat artists would have made clay images. Some of them would have made clay images. They would have certainly painted the clay images. So there was this kind of symbiotic relationship, if you like, between the Kumars and the Chitrakars who made this. But I draw your attention to the stylistic similarities between this image of Narasimha, an incarnation avatar of Vishnu, and the Lion of Durga. I commissioned this from a Chitrakar in India, one in Calcutta, one of the last remaining Chitrakars around. There you have the lion with the moustache, the kind of lion that we've been referring to, the white lion. Now, let me just go through very quickly, going back to the traditional Durga image, what the Durga image is supposed to look like. First of all, you have Durga in the centre, Sarasvati on the left. Hold on, I've got it the wrong way around, actually. Lakshmi on the right. I should have the other way around, actually. Ganesh on the left, and Kartik on the right. Sometimes it can be the other way around, actually. The lion that I've got here, number 6 on this figure, is the kind of lion that I'm referring to, the heraldic Leogriff type lion. If you now look at, with the Mahisha and so on, if you look at this, this is a traditional Durga image from Hatkola Datta family of North Calcutta. There you have this rather curious lion leaping forward to grab hold of Mahisha in this sort of locking embrace, if you like. I'm not sure when this photograph was taken. It's a traditional Durga image, early part of the 20th century. You can see the lion there underneath the clothing. Another form of Durga with Chalchitra. The lion on the right-hand side, this one here, is one of the earliest photographs I've ever seen of a clay image of this kind of lion. It is very, very different to the kind of lion that we've seen so far, in the sense that it is more ornate. You've got the sash there, you've got the mane, you've got all the decorations and so forth, and I've mentioned there all the things which I think make this figure very, very different from what we'd call an ordinary lion. The moustache, the mane, the sash, the decorations, the snout. You won't see a picture of this apart from here, because you can't, you're not allowed to any longer. The Raja of Nadir doesn't allow photographs of this particular image any longer. And this is Raj Rajeshwari from the Rajbari in Krishna Nagar. And it's the Chalchitra that I want you to look at. If you look in the middle, you have Shiva and Parvati with Ganesh. You have the Dasa Avatar on the left-hand side, the Dasa Mahavidya on the right-hand side. And this is showing you what Durga Puja is in many respects. To say it's non-sectarian wouldn't be correct. I would say it's trans-sectarian, or it covers all the things. You have Shiva, Vishnu, Devi, all together in the image. And if you have the Dasa Avatara and Dasa Mahavidya, rather like Devi Mahatmya and the Bhagavad Gita, it's saying that they are of equal importance. And people have commented on the fact that you actually need this Chalchitra. It's part of Durga Puja. They are referred to during Durga Puja ceremonies. Each of these deities are mentioned by name in the Durga Puja ceremonies. And this is what the colouring looks like. There's the lion, a very unusual stylized lion with a moustache. And this figure, this Durga image, predates even the Nabakrishna Deb one. This is probably 1728, was the original way that this image would have been made back in those days. So it's actually keeping that tradition going. So this is probably one of the older images that you'll see in Bengal. This is about 15 feet high. It's in a Takur Dalan in the Rajbari of the Nadia Raj in Nadia district. And this is a close-up of this lion. So what do we notice about it? Well, it's got this decoration. It's got something around its neck. It's got that curious snout. And it's got a sort of gold mane. And again, I put it to you that this is not what I would call a lion, but something slightly different. Back in 1901, Swami Vivekananda decided he would practice Durga Puja in Bellomat, and this is rather a departure for the Ramakrishna mission. It's not their sort of scene really, but they decided that they would do it, and it's hugely popular now. The lion here has changed. This is a more naturalistic lion. Still traditional Durga image, lion is different. So this lion here, don't assume that because you see a traditional Durga image, it'll always be that heraldic lion. There are variations. And I'm going to suggest to you the reasons now why. It would be inappropriate to have the heraldic lion for the following reasons. First of all, the heraldic lion was the kind of lion that would have been commissioned by the zamindars, the local landed gentry, to therefore have one for your own image, if you weren't in that aristocratic sort of league, if you like, would be a bit of hubris, I think. It would be stepping beyond the mark. It would also not be lining up with the tradition. So what the people who I've shown you, the Rajakrishnachandras or the Navakrishnadevas, are saying, we belong to a tradition, it's a medieval tradition, we have a long lineage, we're going back into the past. This one here is embracing more of the present, the future. It's looking beyond the past in that sense. And this is the lion here that we're looking at. This is the Balabhatvan. If you look on the foot of Durga, you can see where this is Dashami, you can see the sindura has been put on the foot. And worshippers will come and take that and put it into a little jar and keep it for the rest of the year for decoration for their forehead and so on, as part of the celebrations. Bharat Mata, this is a representation of India, and the way that India itself is seen now, some may say, with almost like a Durga figure. I'm going to go back right to the start here and just go back to the first image, and I just want to talk about this a little bit more. Okay, but first of all, any questions you would like to ask so far on what I've talked about? Anything you would like to ask a bit more information?
Yes, I wasn't very clear what you were saying about the coin minted in 421 with a very 1421.
Yeah.
With a very Chinese lion, and then you connected that with the opening of the secret city in 1420.
Yes, in 1420.
How do you see the influence flowing?
Exactly, yes.
What were you saying?
Well, I'm saying that anything you see iconographically predates, so there would have been stuff prior to that. So, for example, the Durga of David Mahatmya would have been around for about 200 or 300 years before the David Mahatmya was written. So because something is minted doesn't mean to say that that was the first time you ever saw that kind of image.
That would have been very Chinese looking.
It was very Chinese looking, yes. And there was trade, obviously, between Bengal and China that had been going on for hundreds of years. It wasn't just as though it happened in 1420.
No, so that would be somewhat coincidental.
It is
1421. I mean, it must have been the Chinese influence must have come earlier.
The trade would have come earlier, definitely. Yes, I would say that that's the case. But it doesn't mean to say what I'm trying to say is that the image from the Chandi coin is remarkably similar to any. If you look at the roofs of the Forbidden Palace, you will see exactly the same kind of lion.
Yeah.
And so coins would have been minted and sent across. This is a commemorative coin. This would have been presented to the emperor. So this wasn't a sort of coin that was used for, buying things.
No.
But nevertheless, that Chandi, that image, would have been familiar. And there is some argument that actually it came from India in the first place, many, many years before 1421.
But have you got anything in India which looks as Chinese as that, which is earlier?
Which is earlier? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe you could find out, Richard. I don't know. But I was curious about that. I thought that was a way of linking in with this particular kind of image. But I want to talk about this a bit more, because actually this, from an esoteric point of view, has really quite a lot of significance. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about now is the way that images are used for worship and what they might mean to a worshipper. And when we look at an image like this, it is very difficult to try and understand what's going on unless you look beyond it. Okay. So if I was now to talk about the Rahasya that I was referring to earlier, and also the esoteric understanding of this, this is one Swami's view of Chandi, and dividing the episodes, the three episodes, and so on. So first of all, if you look at this image and you look at the bottom part of it, you have the lion fighting the Asura, who is the demon. Now, I've said to you already that demons are not necessarily bad, and that in fact there could be a good part of it as well. Okay? Now, what Swami Krishnananda says is that what you're doing is you're moving from the tamasic, that is the bottom layer, where you have the lion attacking Mahisha. You have the destruction of all those bad things in your life. Mahisha changes into various things, And this is like the human mind changing and constantly moving. So what's happening is that gradually there's a purification process going on. So if we're looking in terms of tantric sadhana and so on, what you've got here is a movement from tamasic through to the left-hand side with Lakshmi, to the rajasic, and then to Sarasvati on the right-hand side, the sattvic. And so each of these stages looks at a transformation of a human being and the spiritual movement towards liberation, which is Durga in the middle. So in a sense, some people have said, well, why on earth are Lakshmi and Sarasvati included in the image of Durga? They're not related in any shape or form to Durga. Kartik and Ganesh are traditionally her children, but not Lakshmi and Sarasvati. And maybe here you've got the explanation for that inclusion in the Durga image. Okay. There is also something else, that there's a very, very good book which I'd highly recommend to you, which is this one here, which is a book in a series. It's by somebody who's given a talk here before. I don't know how you pronounce her name, Nilima. Chitgopeka, is that right?
Yes.
And she's produced a small book on Durga. And she refers to a particular kind of bhakti, which might sort of illustrate something here which we haven't really discussed so far. And that is something called dvesha bhakti, or hate devotion. And there's a concept derives from the Hindu belief that any contact with a god or goddess, however violent or negative, can always have a beneficial positive effect. The worst sinner, she says, inadvertently commits by his very sin an act of salvation. So Mahisha here, who originally is a suitor for Durga, she rejects his advances. He then turns violent. The outcome of this is, if there can't be another kind of union, then it's a union through death, a union through sacrifice. And there is an aspect of Durga which some people make big things out of, and that is that Durga has martial connotations. So there is a ceremony in which all the weapons of Durga, for example, are worshipped. I've mentioned animal sacrifice. Prior to that, in the medieval times, there was human sacrifice as well. If enemies were caught in battle, they were sacrificed. Some people sacrificed themselves. There is self-immolation. Some people sliced parts of themselves off and gave the blood to the image of Durga and so on. So maybe this links with this idea that actually you can find union with God, with Devi, through an act of sacrifice of some kind or other. And what she says is this: demons can be saved through self-sacrifice. The eradication of all forms of egoism is the prerequisite for redemption. So what she's referring to here is something which I think I will leave you with, and that is the overall impression here. And it's always, I've always looked at a Durga image and thought, well, there's a demon there on the right-hand side. There is sort of disharmony going on here. But actually, this whole image is an image of harmony, because everything in it is encouraging bhakti. The demon may look as though he's fighting, but actually what he's doing is he's supplicating Durga. He is submitting to her. He's performing an act of worship. It may be self-sacrifice, but it's still an act of worship. And the whole lot together is a sort of conjoined effort to show bhakti towards Durga.
There's also the idea that the Devi's weapons somehow purify the demon, that the demon then goes to heaven after being killed by...
Yes, I mean,
turns negative into positive.
There's nothing negative, in other words, in this image. There isn't anything negative at all, although it may look as though it is. On a lesser level, it is the Asuric, the wisdom, that is the lion, represents purity, wisdom, knowledge over ignorance, the Asura. But that's on a very tamasic level. And in fact, if you're looking at it from this point of view, you're trying to rise above it. The only thing I would point out here is that if you go to watch Durga Puja, it would require a very particular kind of person to go through the esoteric understanding that I've explained to you.
Yeah.
Because normally what you'd have is you'd have priests hired, you'd have a family who would very, some families take a lot of interest in Durga Puja and are involved, others distance themselves. So they let the Purohits get on with it and they don't really have much participation. So whether or not the individual wishes to take part in it is another thing. What I would say to you is that Durga Puja is a 5-year obligation. Once you've started, you have to practice it for 5 years. It's actually built into Durga Puja celebrations. It's a commitment, a financial commitment. Having said that, none of the things that I've shown you are necessary, not a single bit of it, because in fact you can practice Durga Puja simply using a pot or a ghat, and in Bengal they call it Ghate Pote Puja, which is a pot and a painting, and that is all you need. So during the war, during famine, none of this would have been used. These are really, the image itself is used in a variety of ways. It's a complex thing. To say an image is used in this way would be far too simplistic, really.
Just one little thing about the, you mentioned the moustache.
Oh, yes.
The lines,
yeah,
to make it human.
Yeah.
I was doing this course, you did the Puranas, and I did an essay on the lion of Durga.
Oh, right.
And I have the theory that the lion represents a devotee of Durga, that it gains power from the Devi, but also can work independently in the Devi Mahano fights.
Yes, the Vahana is in a sense the alter ego of any deity. So what you've got here is Durga being incredibly impassive. I mean, if you can imagine her standing on two moving objects, you've got the demon on the left-hand side and the lion on the right. I mean, she's performing this amazing balancing act, and I think that is actually what we're talking about here, is that Durga is not moved by this. This is Maya, this is Leela, this is play. She is actually engaged in this this activity, and it doesn't really... thing. The other thing is that she is created in the Devi Mahatmya out of the tejas, or the energies of the anger of the gods.
Yeah.
And she is not like any of the other female deities in this respect. She isn't independent of the gods, because she's created out of the energies of the gods. But nevertheless, she is not a consort. She is not a minor. She is, supreme. And in that sense, this relationship, I would say the whole of this, encourage the devotee to get participate rather than just the lion. But the lion is the sort of the active part of what Durga is doing, if you like. The other thing that intrigues me is that the lion seems to know exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does the lion know to grab hold of the right arm of, how does the lion, and this, if you look at the rest of the Devi Mahatmya, the lion is very active, is proactive. So it's not just a sort of mount that sort of carries Durga around, but actually is a companion and also co-combatant in the process.
It laps up the glove.
I mean, the Puranas tell the myths, if you like. The Agamas tell the, explain the ritual, and the Silpa Shastras tell you how to make these images. But the Silpa Shastras really don't tell you a great deal about this. You could there's a lot of liberty involved. You could do the lion however you want, as long as a lot of snarling going on, lots of teeth and lots of blood and claws. I think that's the only bits that are mentioned in the Silpa Shastras, the rules about how you should portray the lion. It should be a vicious creature. Okay. Yeah.
So in this image, on the left it's Lakshmi.
Yes, sorry.
Right,
yes, on the left it's Lakshmi. On the right it's Sarasvati. Yes, I've got those two.
So for those who are worshipping Durga, initially you had the slideshow where you had Kali as being in tamas, Lakshmi
Sattva. Durga is Mahalakshmi, therefore, according to that principle.
Okay, so in some ways it's Lakshmi and Mahalakshmi.
Yes, this puzzles me a bit. I mean, that's actually how it's explained.
Mm.
I think the Lakshmi part of it, let me just clarify what this is about. Lakshmi being, and Maha is often dropped, obviously, nowadays as Lakshmi, but it's the siddhis that you are given wealth by your wisdom. So wisdom brings wealth. So what you do is you destroy the evil things that are preventing you from seeking liberation. That's the tamasic element. That's what we're seeing at the bottom, really, if you like. Then Lakshmi provides you with both perhaps material wealth, which allows you to go off and do your studies and whatever, because you don't have the worries about not having any money. Or she might provide you with the mental wealth or the siddhis and so on. having done that, then you can progress towards the more sattvic, wisdom-orientated thing. But what this is saying is that none of those three is sufficient in itself. In other words, even if you've overcome your tamasic greed, lust, and hatred, and all that kind of stuff, and you've progressed into the rajasic stage, and then even to the sattvic stage, even that is not enough. That actually you have to transcend that, which is why Vijayadashami explains that, you know, only going beyond to God realization can you actually find moksha or liberation. So it's beyond in a sense. So I can understand what you're saying about this division. It's not satisfactory, if you like.
Because actually I was curious about that. Why would they not worship Saraswati if she's, you know, the god?
Exactly,
of goodness?
Yes. But it's not Saraswati is not the top, if you like.
Yeah,
there is beyond.
Beyond the transcendence.
Yes. Yes, there's beyond. Okay.
Okay.
So coming back to your thing about whether the lion is the devotee, I would say perhaps Mahisha is more, perhaps, you know, because of this idea of, you know, even the most terrible sinner, just by merely being in contact with divine, find salvation. So, you know, however horrible and evil you are, when you come close to Devi, just that coming close to Devi is sufficient to spark off the, you know, the liberation process. Which is an interesting, it's quite an interesting sort of perspective, if you like.
It's the prototype that is Ravana. Ravana's
yes.
Lifelong fight is to speak against, deadly fight against Rama.
Well, you know that Ravana worshipped Durga.
Yeah, but I mean the whole idea of Dvesha Bhakti.
Yes.
He's the prototype for that.
Yes, but he was destroyed, and you know why he was destroyed by Durga.
Durga.
Well,
yes, but that's later.
Well, he was allowed.
I mean,
do you know why he was allowed to be?
Back,
do you know why he was allowed to be killed by Rama? Because he failed to do the Rahasya part of the Devi Mahatmya.
Yeah.
So actually, the Devi Mahatmya recitation of Devi Mahatmya has to be recited accurately, with the Angas and the Rahasyas properly.
Yes, we're talking across purposes.
Yeah.
You're talking about within the Devi tradition. I'm just saying within the history of Indian religion.
Yes.
The original Dvesha Bhakti is Ravana.
I suppose you would say that, yes.
Yes.
But I mean, of course, Krishna worships Durga. Rama worships Durga.
So that Durga
is worshipped for overcoming difficulties. So coming back to the notion of Durga as difficulty, so she in a sense overcomes difficulties. If you have a difficulty you want to overcome, you worship Durga, particularly in battle is secured and success is secured in battle through worshipping Durga, which comes back to this, which is 1757, the Battle of Plassey and the victory over the British and the release from Muslim rule and the ability to practice your religious tradition again, and so on. Apparently there was a puja tax. Interestingly, there was a puja tax the Muslims introduced, which made it very difficult for Hindus to practice their puja, because this is extremely expensive. I mean, in the 19th century, Bengalis bankrupted themselves carrying out Durga Puja. It's extremely expensive to do Durga Puja. But the British very kindly released that tax. Of course, they had tax incentives to practice Durga Puja, which meant that the zamindars it was for their benefit to, you know, offset it against tax. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they would invite the British along to their Durga Puja celebrations, and then things got a little bit out of hand. Yes. This is a curious thing. Now, I don't know what you make of my theories. I've not heard anything from the room about whether you agree with me or not about this Durga lion.
I'm very convincing what you're saying.
Yes, you are convinced.
It reminds me of Southeast Asia as well. Some of the lions in Bangkok and so on.
Yes, I mean that, you know, the lions would have been sort of carried across to Indonesia, for example. What is interesting about the Durga images in Indonesia is you don't have the buffalo appearing in these images, and the reason apparently is that the buffalo is extremely revered and is obviously a source of income and to kill a buffalo would be completely beyond the pale.
Mm.
And so images of Durga showing her killing the buffalo are absent. Also in South India, coming back to this Kalika Purana idea, you may not have the buffalo, you may not have the lion, but you certainly do have Durga standing on the head of a buffalo, a severed head of a buffalo. And if Mahisha is in fact Mahesha or Shiva, then you are having the Devi supremely standing upon.
So, but that just doesn't work.
Well,
because it's the wrong S. I know it works in English where you have SH,
yeah,
but there's two different letters in the S.
But if that is the case, if that is the case, that
it's not just that the vowel is wrong, the consonant is wrong too.
But if it's the case that, in fact, an image is showing the supremacy of Devi over Shiva, I'm not showing this one, but I'm talking about in South India, where you don't have the buffalo, you don't have Mahisha, you don't have the lion, you just have the buffalo head with Durga standing on top of it,
mm,
on top of the buffalo head. I think what I would conclude by saying is that, in a sense, it's a rather sad story that I've told today, in a sense, because what we've had is the lion coming from semi-obscurity. In fact, the lion has come from the sidelines into prominence, but now is slipping back into obscurity again. It's losing its efficacy. It's no longer... If you have the naturalistic lion, you've lost everything, in a sense, that we've been talking about this afternoon. So if you have images with naturalistic lions, then you don't really have the idea of a pure white lion. You don't have the path of, you know, that we've been talking about, in a sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jim, for sharing your research with us.
That's
I've
right.
learned a lot this afternoon. It's been very
okay.
stimulating indeed. Thank
You're
you
welcome.
Very much.
I would recommend this as well. This book here is very, very good. It's very easy to understand. And also the website, the Bellomath website, is extremely good as well. If you want to see Durga Puja in action, they have videos and photographs and so on. So tell me what your interests are, your particular interests then. Are you studying Hinduism?
Sanskrit.
Sanskrit, right. Okay.
I'm not. I'm thinking of doing a course, though. I'm a member of the Ancient Knowledge Society.
Right.
So that's kind of... So when you mentioned Mesopotamia, I was
Mesopotamia, yes, yes. Yeah, Ishtar and Nana. Yeah.
Mm. Do you think there is a link there? What do you think?
Whether I think there's a link between Ishtar and Nana.
Not Nana, necessarily.
Ishtar. To be honest with you, I think the strongest link is with Mithras rather than with Ishtar. If you look at the picture, if you look at the images of Mithras, they are closer to what we're looking at here than, in a sense, Ishtar is. Because of this idea, if you look at statues of Mithras, you have the dog and the snake drinking the blood of the bull that's being sacrificed. You also have the initiation rite. You have the sort of mystery part of it. And I think also the sort of figures themselves going together, I think there's more of a link here. And you also have the sun present. Now, if it's true to say that the lion represents the sun, solar deity, and that it is destroying... So in other words, the lion represents light and the asura represents darkness, and darkness is being destroyed by light, which some people say. Some people say that the lion represents light, or, you know, the sun represents, in other words, wisdom destroying ignorance, which is darkness, and so on. Perhaps that is more of a close link, because you have in the Mithras always on the left hand side you have the sun's rays, and so on. But Ishtar herself, I mean, the fact that Ishtar is a kind of wrathful, and this sort of sexual tension part of Ishtar versus Gilgamesh is present here, definitely, with Mahisha and Durga. She is a virgin goddess. She is not married. There's this power within Durga. Some people claim sort of feminism, but I like the description in here where she describes Durga as the epitome of feminine machismo. And I think actually that's the way to look at Durga. She is a very powerful goddess. But as you can see, she's not moved, in a sense, by, like James Bond is not moved by what he does. In terms of iconography, incidentally, most of these images would carry out a lot of the iconographical rules. She is filled with energy. Her skin is slightly sweaty. It's supposed to be a mark of beauty. So they put varnish over it. Her eyes, wide staring eyes, convey energy. She looks as though she's taken a big deep breath. That's standard in most sculpture, this idea that prana, the image is filled with life. So all of the sort of basic iconographical rules are being followed here, and that the images, the figures are young and youthful and vibrant and energetic and so on. But in terms of Ishtar, I don't know. I'm not entirely convinced, is what I would say. But what I would say, and I think people need to embrace this idea, that when you look at Hindu iconography, you tend to sort of compartmentalize it and say this is just Hindu, and in fact it's not. And I hope people have thought this afternoon that it's much more of a sort of blend, a sort of mixture of a whole range of things, Buddhist ideas, tantric ideas, all sorts of things have gone into an image like that. And it's much more of a complex thing. We tend to want to have a simple answer to things, but in fact, at the end of the day, it's much more complex.
Mm. What's the Plassey connection again? Do you...
Oh, the Plassey connection. Well, you know, when Clive fought the Battle of Plassey and won, Rajanabhakrishna Deb, who was employed by the British East India Company, wanted to celebrate his victory.
Oh, I see.
And therefore... started his Durga Puja celebrations. He invited some Kumars from Krishnagar to come down to Calcutta, and that's where Kumartuli was started. So he was some people say, the inaugurator of the tradition of worshipping this kind of Durga on this scale in Calcutta at the time in the 18th century. Very interesting time, by the way. I would say, however, that the period of George III was probably more interesting. A lot of things happened in the reign of George III. Calcutta was founded in 1690, it was supposed to be. And by the time the 18th century hit, I think Durga Puja was beginning to wane a little bit.
Mm.
1840, I would say, is the key point where it changes completely. Mainly because the traditional families that you've got here, the communal festivals that took place from about 1820 onwards, that changed the face of Durga Puja completely.
Mm.
Alright. Okay. Alright, well, thank you for your company. I'll put this on the web so you can.
Oh, yes, great. Yes, these lectures will be on the website, so if you want to revisit this talk and see the images, it will be there very soon.
Okay, so now you know. When you see a lion like that, just think. Next time you go to a museum or see an image, you'll look again at lions and you'll think, "Well, where's this all come
from?" I was amazed that there are lions in India. I didn't think there were any lions in India.
Yep, lions in India.
It's just imaginative.
No. Lions in India. Not in China, though.
No, Pekingese was their attempt to emulate the
Pekingese, yeah, well, the Tibetans, I think. I think they look nicer than the African lions myself.